Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We're going to start looking at Sarasamvadani that goes with text number 9. It's a more elaborate explanation of the pramanas, the ways of acquiring correct knowledge. Before we do that, do we have any questions on the topic? Yes, Prabhu.
The Mangalacharna was until text 8?
Yes, it was. No, until text 7.
Text 7 and 8 and 9. Okay, we started the text.
Yes, or is it 8? 8 is part, yeah, including 8.
Yeah,
eight,
because in the commentary you said...
Yes, 8. From, okay. Eight.
So text 9 is the first verse...
No, I'm sorry. We had... No. It was text... Yeah, text 9 is the first actual.
Okay, it's talking about
yes, it's
pramana, yeah, different types of pramanas.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, but a moment, you had some questions? I think it would be, okay, all right. Yes, sir. This is, okay, but not general questions now. This is questions on the topic.
Yeah, okay. It's on the topic. So, in the very first... in the very beginning of your class yesterday, you mentioned about Anubandha Chatushtaya, these four topics, Vishwaya, Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana. So it seems that all Vishwaya, Abhideya, and Prayojana, they are mentioned in the very in previous verse about Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. So and but Sambandha is Vacha in Vachika. So
yes.
Is it explain it in this verse? Vacha and Vachika means how we can explain our topic and what is a reliable source of knowledge?
No.
What is it?
When it's talking about Vacha, Vachika's bhava or sambandha, it is specifically the relationship between the book that describes the topic and the topic. Between the words specifically, not in general, how words describe. It's not the general science of linguistics. It's establishing that the book you are writing actually does describe the topic. Okay? That's what it means.
And can you tell that finally all this discussion about pramanas, reliable source of knowledge, leads us to Srimad Bhagavatam? So in this section, Shrijiva Goswami seems that he established this sambandha, this connection between topic which he wants to describe and this book, Srimad Bhagavatam. Because first he explained that we cannot understand absolute truth, and he...
This is preliminary. This is preliminary to establish that we're going to take Bhagavatam as our authority. Mm-hmm. Then in the second half of the Tapasandarbha, he will start discussing what the Bhagavatam has to say about the tattva, how Bhagavatam defines the tattva. That is, that second half of the Sandarbha is where you find the Sambandha revealed. Mm-hmm. Or not revealed completely, but just basically... A basic, brief discussion of it is there in the second half of the Tattvasandarbha.
So we can tell that in this section he describes Sambandha.
No, he's preparing to describe Sambandha. First, before we can explain Sambandha, we have to establish what are our means of knowing.
Yeah. And excuse me. And
because actually. We want to establish, Sambandha means how the Bhagavatam describes the absolute truth. Before doing that, he wants to establish that the Bhagavatam should be our authority. Mm-hmm. What do we care what the Bhagavatam says if we don't accept the Bhagavatam's authority? So in order to make it significant that we're going to find out what the Bhagavatam says, its version of the Absolute Truth, we should first of all ascertain that the Bhagavatam really should be accepted as our authority. So that's the whole purpose of the first half of the Tattva Sandarbha.
But isn't it the very meaning of Vachaka that we take some book which is describing topic, and he tells that this very book is Srimad Bhagavatam?
No, we first of all decide what book we're... First of all decide we're going to deal with the Bhagavatam. Well, this is not a comparative study about what all sorts of different books say about the Absolute Truth. First thing he does is establish that we're interested in Srimad Bhagavatam, not all these other books. Okay, it's not a comparative study of what all the different books say about the Absolute Truth. And therefore, after sorting it all out, we find the Bhagavatam has the most valuable thing to say. Now, if we're going to start focusing on Bhagavatam, you know, deciding that we're going to focus on Bhagavatam and use other books only as supplementary support. So that is the focus first, to establish the primary authority of the Bhagavatam. If we don't do that, then we have to deal with contending versions, what the Bhagavatam says, what the Mahabharata says, what some other book says, and sort them out. But if we establish that Bhagavatam is our primary authority, first and last authority, then we don't have to worry about what other books say that might apparently contradict. We reconcile it all to make it agree with the Bhagavatam. Okay. Yes, Madan Mahaprabhu.
Yesterday you discussed some philosophies. You gave a quick kind of tour around different philosophies and their take on the theory of knowledge, like Buddhists, and you quoted...
The two, Nyaya and the Buddhists.
Yes, and yes. Mayavadis also. You mentioned them somewhat, I mean, casually.
Okay.
I want to ask you, is it like when we are talking about different theories about knowledge, can we safely say that all of them somehow or other, explicitly or implicitly, they're based on a notion of self-evident truths? For instance, when Buddhists are talking about truth as something which has to be consistent and practical, then for them the notion of practicality or consistency is a self-evident thing which we don't put to doubt.
What do you mean? Let's clarify, what does self-evident mean?
Means they don't challenge, they don't doubt any further than that. In other words...
But that is just beginning with some assumptions.
Yes.
They may be obvious assumptions, but usually not. Usually a school of philosophy will assume things that are not... It's not obviously true to everybody. Or people in general. Their belief systems are based on assumptions that other people don't agree with. That's why we have different varieties of thought. Because people start with different assumptions. We start with the assumption that... the Buddhists assume. It's their axiom. Or we can say Siddhanta is one meaning of the word Siddhanta, an axiom. They just assume that everything's momentary. They don't prove it. They believe it. We don't believe it. A lot of other people don't believe it. But the Buddhists believe it. That's their assumption. Or someone assumes that Jesus Christ is the only Son of God. Or that the world is just made of atoms and subatomic particles. And if we can understand them, we understand everything. There are different kinds of assumptions. And they're just... I don't know about this self-evident. We assume them. We never question them. And in that sense, they're self-evident. But not self-evident in the sense that they prove themselves. They're not proven. They're just accepted. Believed.
Quest for knowledge starts with some things which a person doesn't challenge. I think it was Socrates who made it very clear that in an infinite digression of question, like, how do I know? there should be some standpoint beyond which we never question, otherwise we question the very basis of our being able to know anything.
Yes.
So that's what I mean by self-evident.
Extreme skepticism leaves you with nothing.
The reason I'm bringing it up is that because we do have to deal with, in the real situation world, we do have to deal with people who are influenced by somewhat Buddhistic philosophies, or very widespread these days. So we have to know how to deal with them when they start talking something of their philosophy. And one of way of dealing with them is to point out their internal inconsistency when they say the truth cannot be understood, and then truth cannot be objectively perceived, but they themselves claim something to be objectively true, like consistency, which they never challenge themselves.
Yes.
So that's one way of dealing with such philosophies, and that's why I wanted to ask if every single philosophy has something as a self-evident, quote-unquote.
Not only every sophisticated philosophy, any kind of thought, even naive thought, even children's thought, you know, like, my father is the best guy around and he'll protect me. The child has an assumption. You know, my father can do no wrong. You know, everybody, philosopher or just a simple person, everybody's seeing the world based on some assumptions. We have our assumptions too, but we think our assumptions are true. They're correct. You know, correspond to reality. There's one absolute truth and his name is Krishna. That's our assumption. Of course, we have evidence for it, but, you know, we have our assumptions also.
There was a debate between Madhvacharya and one Buddhist. What was his name, Bharatam? Buddhisara. Sagara. Uh-huh. Buddhisagara. So they started debating. I saw that movie. And the Buddhists came and sat down and said, I don't believe in the Vedas. Vedas are not pramana for me.
Yes.
And Madhvacharya told him that, I don't believe in logic. Logic is not pramana for me either. Because by logic you can prove right to be wrong. You can prove white to be black.
Yes.
So, and Buddhism was thrown out the window at that time because there was no pramana for any further discussions.
So what'd they do?
So that's what
they decided to have a wrestling match? What did they do? They couldn't come to terms on what to argue about.
Actually, as I showed in that Madhvacharya movie, that Buddhist says Vedas are not pramana for me. So then Madhvacharya says, then how is Tarka pramana either? Because Tarka is based on everybody's assumptions, as you're saying, Shraddha. Everybody has his own set of Shraddhas. So according to his Shraddha, his Tarka will be there.
Yes.
So how can we ascertain the truth by that if you don't have any body of evidence in the Vedas?
Yes.
So then he gave up. But then doesn't come the next day for the debate. He says that let's debate. Madhvacharya says let's debate today.
The Buddhist ran away.
Yeah. He doesn't come the next
day.
And then when the other people in the mutt say that, oh, that guy ran away, he couldn't debate with you, he says, he understood that you cannot ascertain the truth by logic.
Yes. Almost everybody in the world, I'm sorry, I'm changing the topic. Thank you. Almost everybody in the world believes something, has some faith that he's perceiving some reality. That means he's got some pramana that he accepts. A person who can't believe anything, there is no such person, actually. You know, even Albert Camus, who ended up killing himself, he believed that life was purposeless. That's a belief. That's a philosophical axiom. The only problem is it leaves the question, why stay alive? Yeah, it's consistent. He acted consistently, but based on a belief. Based on, he had his pramanas. I can see no purpose in life. So many people are dissatisfied and frustrated. So from his personal perception, which he accepted as pramana, he came to his conclusion. Everybody believes something. And that means everybody has some means of knowing that he accepts as valid. The philosophers are categorized according to which pramanas they accept. But we don't have any group of philosophers who don't accept any pramana. Who is it? The Charvakas? Oh, the Buddhists only accept pratyaksha as really reliable. And the Charvakas too. The materialists of the Charvak school. But nobody's mentioned who has no pramana. Yes, yes.
Hare Krishna. He was addressing, it was Baladeva Vidyabhushana who was addressing the Charvaka in a joking, kind of taunting manner, saying that if Charvaka you believe only in the sense perception, then why are you so upset about the fact that your wife became pregnant by another man?
Yes.
Because you never saw it.
Yeah.
So how do you become
He just sees the effect his wife is pregnant. And he's using logic, but you don't believe in logic. That's why you're upset. Okay, anything else? Otherwise we'll start. We'll look at what Sarvasambhavani has to say about pramanas. I'll read the Sanskrit because we're supposed to know Sanskrit around here. We're reading from the Sarvasambhavani appendix pertaining to text number 9, which we read yesterday. Tatra purushasya iti atraitad uktam bhavati yadyapi pratyaksha anumana shabd arsha upamana artapatya bhava sambhava aitihya chesht akhyani dasha pravanani viditani tatapi Brahma pramada vipralipsa karana patava dosha rahita vajanatmaka shabda eva mulam pramanam. Okay, anyesham praya purusha brahmadi dosha mayatayan yata pratiti darshanena pramanam va tadabaso viti. Purushaya ninetam ashakya twat tasya tu tadabhavat. Okay, translation. The text beginning Tatra Purusha, which is Purushasya, that was the previous text, yesterday's text, states that although 10 means of acquiring valid knowledge are known, sense perception, logic, verbal testimony, the opinion of sages, analogy, hypothetical inference, absence, inclusion, tradition and gesture, the fundamental means of knowing is but one, namely verbal testimony. This one means, this is pramana, this one pramana, consists of statements free from the flaws of inattention, false perception, the tendency to deceive, and inadequate power of the senses. Okay. I'm going to go back to the Sanskrit. Oh, no, okay. Because the other 9 means are mostly flawed by false perception and so on, they tend to give knowledge contrary to the facts. And so people are uncertain whether these are proper means or only shadow means of understanding. Shadow mean of understanding will give you some sort of idea, but not a really correct idea. Faulty means of knowing. Okay, what he's saying is not that other means besides Shabda Paman are totally invalid, but that they're uncertain. you can never be sure whether they're giving you correct knowledge or just a false semblance of correct knowledge. Because people have these faults of perception and judgment in them. Tasya tu tadabhavat. Ato ragya vityanam eva tena eva anyesham bada mulatvat tasya tu nairapekshyat. Yata shakti kvachit eva tasya tai sachivyam karanat. Swadinasya tasya tutan upamardyapi pravittidarshanat. Tena pratipadite vastuni taik virodhum ashakyatvat. Tesham shakti bira sprishye vastuni tasyaiva tu sadaka tamatvat. Okay, translation. Because the one means is free from these weaknesses, the other nine depend on it for becoming firmly rooted. Just as the subjects of a king depend on him for their sustenance. Other reasons for the superiority of flawless verbal testimony are that it does not depend on any of the others, that although the others may assist it as far as they are able, this one independent means of knowing in performing its function is even seen to overrule the others. That a fact established by the one means is irreversible by the others. So Shabda Praman can overrule the other Pramanas, but the other Pramanas can't overrule Shabda Praman. And finally, that it is most effective in proving facts that the powers of the other means cannot even touch. Back to the Sanskrit. Tatahi pratyaksham tavan mano budindriya panchaka janyataya shadvidam bhavet. Patyekam punak savikalpaka nirvikalpaka bedena dvadashavidam bhavati. Tadeva chapunak vaidusham avaidusham cheti dvividam. Among the other means, sensory perception, first one listed, is generated by the mind in five knowledge acquiring senses. Hold on a second, mind shouldn't come first. No, mind does come first in the Sanskrit, okay. Because usually the senses are active first. They come in contact with an object. Then after that, the mind gets involved. But anyway, Jiva Goswami lists mind first. Mano buddhi, because is there a rule of the sandhi, rule of the order of the words in the Dvandva Samas? Mano buddhindriya, he says. Although the actual order of functioning is the indriyas act first. Okay. Pramada? And
Pramada, yeah. I noticed that they're listed in that order in the Sanskrit, Brahma and Pramada, but in the translation that they're inverted.
I mean here. I noticed that too. Let me see where it is. Can you show me, can you read this,
yeah,
the English?
First line of the second paragraph of the English. This one means consists of statements free from the flaws
of an intentional perception. Yeah. It should be false perception and intention in that order. Because it just says Brahmadi in the Sanskrit, right? Brahmadi.
I think it says Brahma Pramada Vipralipsa Karana Bhattava Dosha.
Oh, yeah. No.
Third line of the Sanskrit?
Okay, where is that in Sanskrit? I'm sorry. I just want. Tatapi bhavana dosha rahita. Yeah. Okay. It's not my file. Vishnukanda, could you write down on a piece of paper? First sentence of the second paragraph. Just write that down. I'll remember what it is. Okay. I'll have to check with Jayadeva Maharaj on that one. I think he changed it for English purposes. I'll have to discuss it with him. Okay, back to the Sanskrit. No, we read that already. Okay, now about pratyaksha. Among the other means, sensory perception is generated by the mind and five knowledge-acquiring senses. And thus it appears in six forms, according to where it comes from. It comes from any one of the five senses, like I smell pakoras cooking. I don't see them, but I smell them. So that's coming from the smelling sense. And secondary perception. After your senses have perceived something, you think something about it. You see something out there, big thing. You just see it. That's nirvikalpaka. That's perception directly by the sense, the eye. Then your mind remembers, that's a cow. So there's the mind involved, but it's always, the mind comes second. First the senses, and then the mind may get involved. Sensory perception is generated by the mind in five knowledge-acquiring senses, and thus it appears in six forms. And each of these six can either be reflective or non-reflective. And this results in 12 varieties. I think I discussed what I mean by reflective or non-reflective. But it's the difference between just seeing something and recognizing what it is, giving it a name. Non-reflective means... that's also backwards. Non-reflective means you just perceive something, but you just don't name it. You just have a perception. Like, there's an explosion and you see a big red flash. You don't know what it is. You don't identify it. But when you identify it, such and such blew up. Then it's reflective. Yes. Unidentified flying objects?
Because we identify them as UFOs.
Okay, now we're going to talk about UFOs. But you've given it a name. Now they're called UFOs, so now it's reflective. And this results in 12 varieties, 6 times 2. Sensory perception has two more divisions. Perception by those who are wise and by those who are not. Perception by the wise is reliable. Perception by the foolish is not. Now commentary. Here Srila Jiva begins a long section of the Sarvasamvadini, a long section, that in effect serves as a thorough introduction to linguistics. He's talking about Pramana in general, but then he's going to get into a whole discussion of, he's going to determine that Shabda Pramana is primary authority. Now you have to talk about, well, what is Shabda Pramana? Then you get into all sorts of language questions. And he will. He'll be drawing from various schools of philosophy to help understand what is Shabda, what is language. Because the transcendental reality is understood first by hearing rather than by other empiric means, the transcendental reality. Most of us were introduced to the transcendental reality by hearing. We didn't, you know, in our astronomy laboratory, find it in a telescope or see it on a computer screen. We heard about it. So because transcendental reality is understood first by hearing rather than by other empiric means, a proper understanding of the phenomenon of language, especially the divine language of revealed scripture, should be the foundation of any serious philosophy explaining the ultimate truth. Srila Jiva attaches to texts 9 through 11 this survey of investigations into language on various levels by various traditional schools of thought. Later in the Sandarbhas, he uses each of the methods of analysis he describes here. I mean, he talks about various ways of analyzing texts, language, and he'll use them later on in the Sandarbhas. Sometimes. Readers whose patience is tried by technicalities may choose to bypass this part of the Sarvasambhadani. It gets tough. Okay, so it's in the back of the book. Those who don't want to read it don't have to. The ancient Nyaya school of the sage Gotama defines the verbal means of acquiring correct knowledge as aptavakya, the words of reliable authorities. This definition is broad enough to include both Vedic scripture and the teachings of ordinary authorities. Okay, aptavakya. Apta, in this context, means a reliable person. Vakya is just the words of a reliable person. That's Gotama's in the Nyaya Sutras. It's right there in the sutras. That's his definition of what Shabda Praman is. You know who your father is because your mother said this man is your father. Your mother is a reliable authority on the matter of who your father is. She knows herself directly who your father is, and there's no reason why should she be lying to you. She has no reason to cheat you. There's no inheritance involved that she's going to get if you're established as not the son of that father. There's no reason for her to cheat you, so you can assume that she's a reliable authority on the matter of, not on the matter of what's the absolute truth or astronomy or other things, but she's an authority on who your father is. That's aptavakya. That's Shabda Praman. When your mother says, he's your father. Prabhupada tells about how people have to spend so much time going to work in the modern world. And one child who is 4 years old, and she saw a strange man in the house and asked his mother, who's that? And she said, that's your father. You know, you're a little boy, you sleep, you know, early, and he doesn't come home from work until late at night, and he leaves early in the morning before you get up. You've never seen him before. Okay, this definition is broad enough, okay, to include both Vedic scripture and the teachings of ordinary authorities. The experts in any field of knowledge who actually know their field should be reliable. I have no reason to doubt my mother's testimony that the man she says is my father is actually my father. And so on this matter, I accept her as an authority. Srila Jiva Goswami, however, points to Shabda Praman, verbal testimony, in its higher sense of Vedic scripture, as the only infallible means of knowledge. Maybe my mother is in cahoots with the lawyers to cheat me of my inheritance, and maybe she is lying to me. Human authorities may or may not be as reliable as we presume. as we presume them to be. How do we really know who's reliable about anything? We're making presumptions. And therefore, the reliable of their opinions is never absolute. The reliability of their opinions is never absolute. So ordinary Shabda Pramana, just the opinion of some authority, if it's an ordinary authority, it's not absolute. It's not absolute Pramana. It's just maybe it's correct. Or likely to be correct. No reason that we know why it's incorrect, but maybe there's a reason we don't know. But Vedic literature we accept. This is our axiom. We're astikyams, not Gnosticas. We accept the authority of the Vedas. We presume, it's our axiom, that the Vedas don't lie. They know and they tell the truth. Pratyaksha, or sense perception, is the means of knowing the world outside ourselves through contact with the mind and senses. Each of the five gyanendriyas, or input senses, has its own proper kind of object. Visible form for the sense of sight, the feel of things for the sense of touch, and so on. The mind further processes the perceptions of the five senses, adding verbal understanding and thoughts connected by logic. So the other pramanas are used to process sensory perception, to do something with it, or carry it further. According to some of the commentaries on Gotama's Nyaya philosophy, Nirvikalpaka Pratyaksha is raw perception before it is categorized, and becomes Savikalpaka, a definite perception, the way the image of a cow is soon recognized as a cow. Some commentators. Gautama Rishi, we don't know when he wrote the Nyaya Sutras. We can say maybe before Kali Yuga began. The earliest commentary we have on Nyaya wasn't written until about 250 AD. The Buddhists started writing books on logic about 100 or 150 AD. And actually, it was, the Buddhists were very prominent at that time. They still had a lot of influence in India, though it was starting to decline. That's why they started developing logic. Previously, before that, Buddhists turned their nose up at logic and didn't want to get involved in it. A Buddhist would say a thing like, I won't say that it's true. I won't say that it's not true. I won't say that it's not true or not true. They would just play word games to avoid any logical analysis. But by the first century AD, the Buddhists were threatened by reactions against them. The Brahmins, the Hindu, if you want to call them Hindus, were starting to gain prominence again, and the Buddhists were in danger of being discredited. So they started using logic to defend themselves. And Dharmakirti, in about 150 AD, wrote the Nyaya Bindu and a few other books. Only after that did the Vedic Brahmanas get involved in reviving the ancient school of Nyaya taught by Gotama, which over the centuries had been forgotten. So, and this, they started writing commentaries on Nyaya about 250 AD, which who knows how many thousands of years that is after the Nyaya Sutras were written and forgotten. So some of the more subtle things that Gautama talks about in very concise sutras, the commentators had a guess in some cases what he was talking about. They didn't have an intact tradition to tell them. This is one of the things. What's Nirvikalpaka and Savikalpaka and Nirvikalpaka? Different commentators make different guesses, different attempts to define. So one of the most accepted but not the only definition is this one. That when you see something but don't name it, don't assign it a category, then it's Nirvikalpaka. That's the first perception. You see something first and then you recognize what it is and give it a name. And when you recognize it and give it a name, then it's called Savikalpaka. That's one interpretation. It's the most commonly accepted of what Gautama meant by that. Yes, I'm sorry. That's what I translated as reflective and non-reflective. Okay. But the non-reflective comes first. Now, I said that the mind is also one of the sources. There are six kinds of pratyaksha, and when it comes from the mind, that's one of them. That's the sixth one. I gave you as an example what actually is Savikalpaka Jnana, Savikalpaka Pratyaksha. When you see a cow and then later say it's a cow, that's an example of you see the cow, that's visual perception, and then the mind supplies the remembrance that's called the cow. That shape is what in my memory banks I have stored as cow. That's actually just the mind extending the visual perception. But there are perceptions purely from the mind. You know, you're just feeling some pleasure or pain, some anxiety. I don't know what to do with my life. That's a perception coming directly from the mind. You know, you feel an emotion. That's mental perception. The origin of it is the mind itself. That's the sixth category. Go ahead.
Like a person criticizing you, for example, then the other person will feel bad about it. He hasn't, well, he heard it.
Well, yeah. But it's... Well, there's two different perceptions there. Somebody said something to me. That's actually Shabda Praman. Well, it's Shabda. Somebody says something to me. My mind processes the words he said and I recognize what they mean. And then I react. You know, that's really discouraging. So I feel something. But that's a subsequent perception coming directly from the mind. The first perception of what the words mean generates an emotional reaction. So it's actually another perception, and that one's the second one is coming from the mind.
That's protection.
Yeah. You know, I feel like I've had all the wind knocked out of me. It's not because of some physical thing, it's because of a mental reaction. Okay, we're going to stop here for today. The last sentence here is, the other means of knowing are described below. So we'll discuss the other means of knowing starting tomorrow. Okay, Matsya Prabhu and then Vishwakanta?
Yeah, just on the subject of Nirvikalpaka and Savikalpaka, does it also apply like the sound? Like you just mentioned, like at first you may just hear a raw amount of sound and then you understand.
You hear some
meaning.
Nice music and you remember, oh yeah, that's Mozart's 40th symphony.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so it applies to all the different kinds of perceptions.
Them, yeah. You smell something, what is that? And then you remember what it is. Okay. That, you know, my neighbor is fertilizing his lawn with chicken manure. Sometimes it stays near Vikalpaka. Most often because you don't focus on something. We're perceiving a lot of things all the time. And we only focus on and identify some of them. And others, we don't know how to identify, and they stay unidentified. but largely because of inattention, which is necessary to live a normal life. If you have to pay attention to anything, everything that happens, you go crazy. So we perceive some things, but leave them nirvikalpaka and don't think about what it is. You know, I may see a fly on the wall, but I don't say, oh, there's a fly. I don't care if there's a fly there. It means nothing to me right now. If the fly was on my nose, I might think about the fly. But on the wall, I don't care.
Okay. The four basic faults which you mentioned, that imperfect senses and so on, and cheating. And so these four faults are accepted by the other schools also?
I don't know. I don't know. Probably not. Probably not.
Where is it coming from?
I don't know about accepted. They may be ignored. The discussion of the faultiness of human perception and human judgment. Not necessarily every philosophical school deals with that same discussion. I don't think someone's going to deny it and say, no, human judgment is always perfect. It's hard to justify, to prove that everything everybody does and says is perfect. It isn't, obviously. But it's a question of whether you're going to bother to recognize it and talk about it, the fact that human judgment is imperfect. Some philosophers may not deal with that. They may just leave that for someone else to talk about. But they can't credibly deny it. They just ignore it or don't talk about it.
So if it is undeniable and...
let's say it is undeniable.
So if it is undeniable,
that ordinary perception and judgment is faulty, okay.
Then the whole fact that all the other schools have come from a particular person, like Gautama wrote the whole Nyaya Sutras and Jaimini wrote the whole Mimamsa. So,
Vyasadeva wrote the Vedanta.
Yeah, so the whole different schools are originating from a person's realizations or understanding on certain subject matters, and he has written down. So we can apply this four faults to even those people because they are also human beings. And so we can even deny the whole school altogether without even getting...
Well, we can deny that. We can say, and some will definitely say, most of the teachers in most of the universities in the world today will tell you there's no absolute authority. There is no absolute authority. There's just different opinions.
But Vedic literatures don't have a person behind...
Which?
Vedic literatures. The Vedas don't have one person writing down something.
Didn't Vyasadeva write them down?
He just compiled it.
Okay.
That's an axiom.
It's aparishaya. Yeah.
So it is aparishaya. So we can say that these four faults don't apply to the Vedas. And because of that, that is the only authority. Is that a valid argument?
Yes. And a rishi who writes his own book is accepted as reliable when he follows the Vedas. When he doesn't contradict the Vedas and he agrees with the Vedas, then he's reliable. Anybody is reliable if he follows the Vedas.
But is it that out of the six, only Vedanta follows according to Vedas and other five are deviating? Is it like, at least the conclusions of it? So,
to some extent, every other pramana is imperfect. But we have to live with them. If we're going to reject pratyaksha because it's imperfect, we will refuse to accept any evidence of our senses, how are we going to study the Vedas? We have to read them. We have to recognize the words. We have to hear them and recognize the words. For that, we have to use pratyaksha. Pratyaksha has to come first. It's not a primary importance, but in order of application, it comes first. First, you have to hear the Vedas. And then you can receive the knowledge of the Vedas. And if you refuse to accept the evidence of your ears, you'll never be able to receive the Vedas. So we have to use the imperfect means in order to acquire, in order to access the perfect means.
Even inside the Vedic literatures, many of the Samhitas, everything are got by some sages. They revealed it. So
yeah, otherwise we wouldn't have them.
So if someone else says that, if those rishis are all subjected to these four defects, so how do we...
Yeah, the Veda might be perfect, but he may have gotten it wrong. He may only be a certain percent right. He may have made mistakes in recording the Veda.
So if someone objects like this, then how do we prove that? I mean, those Vedic literature, the Samhitas and Upanishads and all, revealed by...
If someone's going to be skeptical like that, then okay, theoretically you've got some divine authority coming from the Akash, you know, records or somewhere, that's perfect, unauthored authority, but you have to get it, receive it from persons. Unless you have a direct, you know, USB link to the Akash records, you're going to have to hear the Vedas from somebody. And that somebody may distort them. That's an argument that will be given. That because the Brahmanas who give us the Vedas are imperfect people, and sometimes very imperfect people, therefore there's no reliable way to use the Vedas. That's a skeptical stance someone could take. And he'll remain a Nastika. He'll say the Vedas are there, but we can't access them. That's as good as saying the Vedas are useless, you know, that the Vedas aren't authority. They're authority, but nobody can get near them. That's also a very extreme skeptical position. People may take it, and that's a great misfortune, because you can't do much to help such people.
Any other argument to disprove that, to refute that?
What's the argument? The only sensible argument I can think of is that so many people with good intelligence and good character and good reputations do accept the Vedas and have accepted the Vedas over centuries and millennia. That's an argument. But I don't know any other proof that the Vedas are perfect. We just accept it. But a lot of people have accepted it. A lot of good people, smart people have accepted it. Yes. The best people have accepted the authority of the Vedas. And we can demonstrate how they're the best people. That they're better than the people who don't accept the Vedas. That we can give some demonstration.
There was one argument against this, that when people ask that, is there proof that Vedas are the highest authority? So if they are asking for another proof that justifies or that gives the status of being a proof to the Vedas,
yes,
then that other proof, that would be a higher evidence than the Vedas. And since the Vedas themselves are the higher evidence, they don't have anybody else. Yes. They don't require anybody else to tell them that they are the proof. And if there was such a thing, then Vedas would not be the highest evidence.
Yeah. The king is not elected. He took the throne by his strength, by force. He took the throne and became the king because he was the strongest man with the strongest willpower. He made himself the king, not that he was elected. So the Vedas are authority, they're swatak pramanya of the Vedas. The Vedas establish their own authority. No other pramana has the power to establish the authority of the Vedas.
Nastikas are people who don't accept the Vedas.
Prabhupada says that also. Although we generally translate it as atheist, but the technical definition is someone who doesn't accept the authority of the Vedas.
But the Buddhists accept pratyaksha as true, is it?
Yeah, they accept pratyaksha, but they don't accept shabda praman.
But the Mayavadis don't accept pratyaksha also, because pratyaksha, they see that things are different, but still they...
No, they say, like we do, that pratyaksha is not absolutely reliable. We do use it, we do accept it. If we didn't, we wouldn't be able to perceive the Vedas.
Yes.
Madhva says that in Katad Lakshanam. About we do accept the practical reliability up to a point of pratyaksha in order to have access to shabda.
Yeah. And also, isn't it that there is a region of pratyaksha? Like if somebody pinched us and it pained us, if the shabda pramana said otherwise, there's no reason to mistrust that. In other words, there is some limit to pratyaksha which we make it liable to be changed by any other pramana. Like if somebody pinches us, it pains, and we'll not listen if any pramana says anything else that it actually didn't pain us, because ultimately it depends on what we perceived as pain. It really pained us. Like, so isn't it that the Vedas are just an extension of the Pratyaksha. In other words, the Vedas are the Pratyaksha of somebody else whose senses are perfect.
No, because the Vedas are authoritative even if nobody hears them. Even if nobody's listening, they're still there and they're still authoritative. So they don't depend on Pratyaksha. Even if for millions of years no one listens to the Vedas, they still remain authority. So no, they don't depend on Pratyaksha. We depend on Pratyaksha to use the Vedas, but the Vedas don't need Pratyaksha to be authority.
They don't need, but they are the Pratyaksha of perfect beings. They are the Pratyaksha of perfect beings. They don't depend on the Pratyaksha, but they are...
The Pratyaksha of perfect beings. No. The perfect beings do perceive the Vedas. The perfect beings have perception of the Vedas. But the perception of the Vedas and the Vedas themselves are two different things. The Vedas exist separate from all perception. Then some people perceive them. But that's perception of the Vedas. That's not the Vedas themselves. Perception of the Vedas may be invalid. I may be reading the book upside down. Or hearing it from a person who doesn't know the mantras right. So my perception of the Vedas, even though the Vedas are perfect, my perception of them may be imperfect. So my perception of the Vedas and the existence of the Vedas are two different things. Okay, Sarvaka and then Dharmada Gopal.
So
and then we stop after that.
We have two sages, they are called Mantra Drashtaraha, who can perceive Vedas.
What are they called?
Mantra Drashtaraha. It's one term, it's used by Bhaktivedanta Maharaj. So it's like we have many hymns of Vedas, many mantras of Vedas, many portions of Vedas which we received in meditation. So, how we can be sure that their perception is correct? For example, we have some Upanishads, or Gayatri mantra, and before chanting every Gayatri mantra, we have to remember sage through whom it was revealed. So
we have the authority of Vyasadeva, who at the end of Dwapara Yuga, before the beginning of our current Kali Yuga, collected the Veda Samhitas. Part of a supplement to the Vedic Samhitas is the table of contents, Anukramani, which lists who's the rishi for each mantra. So the mantras that Vyasadeva included in his version of the Samhitas that he taught to his disciples and as we've received, that's authoritative. On Vyasadeva's say-so. We accept Vyasadeva's authority on what actually is the Vedic text that we've received. Someone else may write a phony Veda, but Vyasadeva had nothing to do with that, so that's not reliable. And the rishis who are listed in the table of contents that Vyasadeva gave us, they're accepted as authorities because Vyasadeva accepted them.
Yeah, but it's in the case of Vyasadeva, but before Vyasadeva, for example, one received this mantra and they started to use it, but how we can know that this mantra received is
from the previous Vyasadeva. There's always one Vyasadeva every time around, every Dwapara Yuga. So before the current Vyasadeva, there was a previous Vyasadeva.
Yeah,
and he's the editor of the Vedas, editor and publisher. He's the authority. Just like the BBT is the authority of what goes into our books. So Vyasadeva is the universal BBT. He's the authority. Yes. And there's always some Vyasadeva. You know, every cycle of ages there's a Vyasadeva.
For example, in Satya Yuga, Treta Yuga, Dvapara Yuga, when there is no Vyasadeva yet.
No, every cycle of four ages Vyasadeva appears at the end of Dwapara. So...
But
that Vyasadeva said and wrote and taught is remembered until it's time for the next, you know, it's gradually lost in each one age after another. It's at the end of Dwarpa that it's lost altogether, and then another Vyasadeva has to appear. But there's always part of the original Vedic knowledge that's remembered. It diminishes as each age progresses.
beginning of Satya Yuga.
Well, just like Matsyadeva appears and speaks the Vedas. But that's, you know, that happens sometimes. But unless there's an annihilation and the Vedas are wiped out or some demon swallows them, they're preserved from the Kali Yuga into the next Satya Yuga. Someone preserves them, hides them away in a jar or something, or remembers them and teaches them to his disciple, and they're continued into the Satya Yuga, unless there's some special circumstances by which they were lost. Then there's some incarnation or somebody who recovers them. Yes?
Excuse me. But the question, for example, if in Satya Yuga some sage comes and some Vedic hymns is been revealed through him, so and there is no yet Vyasadeva to confirm it, so how we can know that this revelation was correct? How we can judge that he received a proper mantra? That
the brahmanas in those days used to collect together in assemblies to discuss these questions of authority and proper practice and proper understanding. They would get together and consult each other and come to a collective decision. So before, you know, in the earlier ages, Satya, Dvaita, and first Bodhidvarpa, that's how the Brahmins would have consultations, assemblies, and decide what's authoritative amongst themselves. So it was a consensus opinion of the well-educated Brahmanas.
On the basis of this decision of this council, we can rely on this decision that this mantra was...
Well, the Brahmins would go back from their councils. They would have them often in various places and teach their disciples what they decided. And it would be passed down through the disciplic successions of each branch, of each school.
But... excuse me, but talking about this, just some doubts
yeah.
arising. Like we have democracy, people are coming together, they're speaking and they're deciding, okay, it must be like this, this law should
yes.
be accepted. But what is the difference between this council of Brahmanas
yes.
and what we have now?
Demos in Greek means the common people. When the common people rule, that's a democracy. When the lowest denominator prevails by popular vote or whatever. When only a few people, the superior people, make the decisions, that's an aristocracy. So there's the Brahmins are the most intelligent and reliable people. When they, you know, the best Brahmins come together, maybe a lot of Brahmins come together, but the best ones, the chief ones, are the ones that are going to have the most say. And their opinion will prevail, the best Brahmins. So when the best Brahmins are deciding what's right and what's wrong, that's much more reliable than, you know, a universal popular vote. It's not democracy, it's aristocracy of the Brahmins. Mm-hmm. In the beginning of Satya Yuga, okay, everyone's a Brahmin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But anyway, even in this case, when we have such a learned Brahmanas, there must be Krishna behind, because otherwise everyone, even in this case of decision, there may be some mistakes. So Krishna somehow should agree to reveal to this consultation of this Brahmanas in order to make
well, okay, but practically,
correct decision.
Practically, they usually manage to sort things out. When there's disagreement, they have debates. You know, and they carry the debate to the point that things are settled. Someone's proven wrong and someone's proven right. Usually, it can be settled in the previous ages. It's when we get near Kali Yuga where people can't come to a proper agreement. And then Vyasadeva has to appear. But in previous ages, they manage usually to sort things out so that the basic truths are agreed upon. Then there are different branches. Like there are different Dharma Shastras And there are different rishis writing textbooks on how to perform sacrifice. Even for the same Veda, there may be several different textbooks, one by this rishi, one by that rishi, how to put the mantras together into a sacrifice. And they can have differing opinions. One says, use this mantra. The other one says, no, use this mantra. It's not that one is right and one is wrong. They're just two different ways, two different versions of the same sacrifice. According to so-and-so rishi, and according to the other rishi, different versions of the same kind of same sacrifice, they're both authoritative. There can be variety, there can be different opinions. It doesn't mean that one has to be right and the other wrong.
So, in this case, maybe...
If they're reliable, they're not going to speak nonsense. Yeah. A reliable Brahmin doesn't speak nonsense, doesn't lie and doesn't talk when he doesn't know what he's talking about.
Maybe in this connection we can tell that because Brahmanas, because Brahmanas or Vaishnavas, they tell something to Krishna. Krishna, who is behind, he agrees to presence in this branch of sacrifice. For example, we have one branch and Krishna is present in this branch, and because of that the sacrifice works and it's authority.
Yeah.
And then because we have some other version, but because it was settled by Brahmanas, and Krishna also wants to be present in the sacrifice.
Yes, when the reputable Brahmanas direct the worship, Krishna feels obliged to reciprocate. Even if something was done, they come up with a strange way of doing things, Krishna will accept it. Okay, we have to stop now, we're late. We'll continue tomorrow. Thank you all. Glory to Srila Prabhupada, Sri Tattva Sandarbha, Sri Jiva Goswami Ki Jai.